This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
We've lost sight of actually some of the real reason why this has started. And actually, I'm worried about the fact that people can feed off of complete fake news and then it can cause such destruction. I think we do have to reflect on that in terms of how our society responds to information.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And I'm joined by Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And the KM Group political editor, Paul Francis, who joins us for his take on what's happening in Westminster.
Hello there.
And our special guest is the newly elected MP for Chatham and Aylesford, Tris Osborne, who talks about his new job, far-right protests and how Labour plans to govern. Okay, first up, Dan, what's been going on in your neck of the woods?
So I spent Wednesday night on what was almost a wild goose chase amid rumours of planned far-right demonstrations and unrest in a few places in Kent. But where I was in Dover, it wasn't as exciting as some of the places.
Yeah. But so bring us up to speed. Why did people think there was going to be a disorder in Kent and the country on Wednesday night?
On Monday, after a weekend of rioting and unrest in various parts of the country, a message started circulating on various sort of far-right and fringe political telegram groups, alleging to list a series of places that you know, far-right and anti-migrant demonstrators planned to attack, vandalise or something of the sort. Three of these places were in Kent, one in Dover, one in Chatham, one in Canterbury. And they were all sort of immigration law and advice firms, or at least used to be. The ones in Dover and Canterbury were closed for some time. But as a result, you know, there was a lot going around on social media and people were pretty interested and thought something was going to happen.
So what actually happened in those places?
Like I said, across all three of those places, there were a lot of social media attention. It was basically a game of Chinese whispers, a lot of people claiming stuff had happened during the day when nothing in fact had. In Canterbury, nothing at all happened. A lot of businesses closed early, but there was nothing. Chatham, there was a sort of reasonably sized protest in there and counter-protest near the Innovation Centre. But where I was in Dover, it was a whole lot of nothing until later in the evening, essentially. I spent all evening traipsing around Dover and found no demonstrators anywhere at any of the planned meeting points. But later on, I ended up finding a group of about 20 sort of counter-protesters huddled in a car park, faces covered, carrying signs with sort of anti-fascist and pro-migration slogans. So basically, they ended up standing in a car park for a couple hours. One had a scuffle with a photographer and got arrested for it. And there were definitely a few people around who were involved with far-right groups sort of out spotting for them, I guess. But they were basically just walking around and making jibes rather than demonstrating in any organised way.
Okay, and what did the people who were there say?
Basically, none of them would speak. The sort of anti-racist or anti-fascist protesters, you know, refused to speak, refused to show their faces. Yeah, they wouldn't even verbally say no comment. They just shook their heads. But I'm pretty certain none of them were local. You see a lot of the same people at these type of things, you know, people who've been around with Stand Up to Racism, the SWP, and all these groups for a very long time. But none of these people were of that sort. They're all quite young. Signs were homemade. They looked like they'd travelled in. Basically ready for trouble of some sort, but they didn't end up getting it, really. And eventually they sort of slowly filtered out, escorted by police into cars, which they organised as rides home for themselves.
Turning to Robert, what about Medway? What's been happening?
So, since we last spoke, Medway Council has published its first round of budget monitoring. And as may be familiar to those who took notice this time last year, it found that the authority is predicted to overspend its budget by £16 million. It's worth saying that these are projections and estimations, and they're likely to come down. However, the fact that the overspend is so high is a cause for concern, because it's a long way for it to come down.
You say this is familiar. How does the overspend compare to previous years?
So, last year, the authority faced a £17 million overspend prediction, which was whittled down, but the council did eventually have to spend £5 million of its reserves. It also had to make cuts to services like free swimming, introduce and increase parking charges, and it also received exceptional financial support from the central government, which allowed them to borrow in order to cover running costs while it got things in order.
And what's the reaction been to this?
Well, the Labour groups say it's still the effects of the previous Tory administration and the recently departed Tory government, but they also say they will make tough decisions to to get this sorted, basically saying they balanced the budget last year and they'll do it again. The Tories, however, say this is very worrying that the overspend is so significant just a couple of months after the budget was set, and the Cabinet needs to get things back under control to avoid using reserves. The Council have until February to reduce the overspend, but we'll see in the regular reports before then just how well it's managing to rein in its spending.
And what have you been looking at of late, Simon?
Well, I've been to two children's centres, one in Thanet and one in the Isle of Sheppey at Sheerness, which face a bit of an uncertain future as Kent County Council continues its relentless drive to find efficiencies. Millmead in Margate and Seashells in Sheerness provide family hub services, which is a place for advice and places where children can find things to do, as well as their parents going on courses and getting advice on how to live their lives. But they generally happen to be in two of the most deprived areas in Kent. But those services are under threat because KCC has spotted a £426,000 saving. And this is in the context of the council having to find more than £100 million in the next couple of years.
And how's that plan to cut these services gone down?
Well, Seashells will have to shut the service down, but not the centre, as it's a hub for a lot of other things which it provides under its own umbrella, but of which the family hubs is one. But there's a different story for Millmead, which depends on its share of £426,000 to run its 60-odd place nursery, and it will have to shut down if the operation goes with it. So the staff are naturally distraught, as are the volunteers and the users, because it also will be the food bank. There's a subscription food service which helps people just to get by from day to day. The proposals are now in consultation, and that ends next month. KCC has in both cases offered alternatives so that users of the centres do not lose the services entirely. But campaigners like Labour's Barry Lewis has invited members of the Children's, Young People and Education Committee to push a pram for 3 miles, which he says is the round trip distance between Millmead and the new centre, just to get an idea of what it might be like. So the guys at Millmead are realistic and they give themselves just about a 5% chance of survival. But KCC, in fairness, has made it plain that given the choice, they would never choose to shut the children's centre down, but that's got the choice that it's been left with.
I'll say, if they're cutting stuff like that, surely KCC must be running out of things to try save money on, right?
That's a good question. It's a big problem, and the problem's only going to get bigger. There is little or no help coming from this new Labour government to the overwhelmingly Tory County Council, and will be faced with plundering its reserves yet again. And as one senior official said to me this week, they might have to consider what has been described as a cull of staff who could be deemed non-essential. However, that's something that thus far has been firmly resisted by KCC. Now we turn to Paul Francis, the KM Group political editor, who's been hearing a lot about civil war in the UK on the back of these riots. Sure, that's a bit overblown, isn't it, Paul?
Well, not to some, but personally, I think it is, despite what some are saying. And it's perhaps telling that these claims are being led by Elon Musk, the guy who owns X, as we call it now. But even amongst the conspiracy theories, it's a little bit over the top. One latest version is that the unrest has been fomented deliberately by Labour to make the PM appear authoritative. Having said that, the riots are not perhaps what Sir Keir expected to face in his first few weeks. And if there was a political honeymoon, it seemed to pass most of us by. But part of the job is to deal with the unexpected, and it's certainly that. Now, a couple of points. As we all know, budgets of public sector are under increasing strain, and policing and managing these riots is costing a fair whack, just in terms of the potential overtime that officers are raking in. And in time, we'll see council leaders and others say that if community cohesion is what we must focus on, then the government will have to stump up the money, and that will be needed to pay for such initiatives. And we all know the parlous state of local authorities.
How's the PM dealt with this crisis?
Well, it depends which pollster you listen to. And according to one opinion poll, not too bad. It suggested that 60% of Labour voters thought he was doing OK in handling the riots. However, that's not necessarily what the party faithful think. But those floating voters who were instrumental in getting him to Downing Street are more important. And they've been less impressed. And according to a YouGov poll, 31% of voters thought he was doing well, against 49% saying he was doing rather poorly. Now, one thing I've been struck by is his uncompromising tone and refrain about the perpetrators facing the full force of the law. It reminded me of someone called Maggie Thatcher, who has PM fashioned the Conservatives as the natural party of law and order. I wonder if Sir Keir's after the same thing.
OK, well, listen, thank you very much, Paul. Please join us later on when we have a further discussion.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast?
Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to Kent Politics Podcast at thekmgroup.co.uk.
Just over a month ago, our special guest this week was a secondary school teacher, but after taking the Chatham and Aylesford seat on July 4th, he's one of Kent's 11 Labour MPs in the Palace of Westminster. Welcome, Tristan Osborne.
Hello.
Well, let's start there. What was the transition like from being a school teacher to being an MP?
Well, goodness. A day before, I was in the classroom teaching 8H and 7B, and then the election happened, wow, what a difference. So it's a bit like a deer in headlights, really, when you go in on that first day and you get a tour of the building. You do have to pinch yourself. There's a bit of imposter syndrome. Am I really here? Am I actually the MP? But actually, the staff in Westminster have been really friendly, very encouraging, and we've been given too many induction sessions to name, and it's getting your feet under the table at the moment and getting the office set up and getting your head around all of the different processes and procedures.
And how have you found the place? Is it what you expected it would be like?
Well, it's certainly a bit more of a maze than I thought. The building has multiple corridors. There are rooms that lead into rooms. Some people have even called it a bit like Hogwarts in terms of its sort of scale. In terms of the role, look, there are things about it which I, you know, wasn't aware. I think some of the security issues, I think that's relatively new. The procedure and how you're supposed to address other members of parliament, and just generally how, you know, the offices and processes are set up. Some of it's very old fashioned, some might suggest. But actually, it's a real honour to be there, and, I'll get my head around it.
Is there anything that sort of particularly surprised you? Any sort of real oddities of the place that people maybe don't know about?
Well, I suppose it's the fact that everyone is in a sort of white tie, which some of the staff around the House of Commons are in white tie. It's all very paper based, which you'd be surprised about now. We've got laptops and other types of things. The voting lobbies, you'd think, given most other democracies, you kind of vote in person with a button or whatever. They're still old-fashioned. You still go down a lobby and you still have to speak to someone, and the whips are there to sort of count you in and out. So I think there's still some things which are quirky and probably go back to our heritage as a democracy. So, but I think people will be surprised to know that we're still voting the same way.
As I mentioned in the intro, Kent went from having just one Labour MP before this election on July the 4th to 11. I mean, how do you explain that shift, that massive shift from lots of Conservative heartlands to Labour?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's probably people out there who are much wiser than me who've given some comment to this, but I think four things sort of scream to mind. First of all, 14 years of Conservative government, people itch for a bit of a change. There was that mindset and mood in the air. Secondly, I think because of some of the conditions of people's lives, cost of living crisis, Liz Truss, perhaps, depending on your viewpoint, causing a bit of a tumult with the economy, and some of the issues with COVID and parties. I think all of those sort of culminated in a desire to punish the governing party. Thirdly, I do think that Labour did put forward a more centre-left agenda this time. We were appealing to people perhaps that we didn't do last time, and that reached across the aisle to many Liberal supporters and former disillusioned Conservatives, One Nation Conservatives in particular. And then fourthly, I think we had a really good campaign, actually. I think it was very positive, it engaged people, and I'm not sure Rishi Sunak had the campaign that he was planning. I think from day one, when he was rained on, to making some gaffes about Wales football teams being in the Euros, not quite so sure he had the campaign he wanted.
And in specifically your seat of Chatham and Aylesford, I mean, in 2019 it was won by the Conservatives with a massive 18,000 majority, which you've now overturned. That was under Tracy Crouch, who's obviously a very popular Member of Parliament for the area, but this time she decided not to stand. Do you think if she hadn't made that decision, if she had stood, would it have been a different result?
So that's a really good question. She was a really popular MP. She's been great on the handover with me, highly regarded with all of the people that I've spoken to. And I even said that in my election address, that I sort of paid sort of diligence to her service. And I'd still do that today. I'll be mentioning her in my maiden speech in September and all the work that she did. I mean, I don't know is the answer to that question. There was a ground, there was big swings across North Kent. We had popular MPs who were still Tory standing who lost, and you had similarly new candidates in other areas that might have won. So, you know, you could say the what ifs and if whats, but the reality is that she did stand down for personal reasons. Mm-hmm. She now has her life back in some ways, you know, privacy, and she can do other things. I know she's gone on to agency work, so, and I pay diligence to her, and I will be hoping to continue that track record of real service to the community, alongside her predecessor, of course, Jonathan Shaw, who mm-hmm. served the community for 13 years as well.
Now, the new government has faced some challenges in the first month that it's been in office. The first was around sort of the King's Speech and the SNP's amendment to lift the two-child benefit cap. Now, you voted against that amendment. Can you explain why?
Yes, I can. So amendments like that are not usual for the King's Speech. This is the King's Speech is the programme for all of government that is put forward. That was a particular amendment on a budgetary item concerning a welfare bill. So actually, there is a precedent for that potentially to come back later on when we're discussing welfare in particular, and we can look at that issue. But more fundamentally, actually, is, and this was highlighted in last week, really, when Rachel Reeves said, look, we've inherited a worse situation than we foresaw. And this was a letter released by the OBR that suggested that there are £22 billion of a black hole in the in-year budget. So the reality is we've got some really difficult decisions to make. Some of them aren't popular. The winter fuel allowance reduction is one that is not going to go down well with certain communities. And we have to make difficult decisions. And that was not the right moment for that proposal. And secondly, I think now we've seen the budgetary situation, I'm not so sure that it's affordable in the current financial year.
Obviously, seven Labour MPs did vote for that amendment and they were suspended by Sir Keir Starmer. Do you think that was a bit too harsh?
No, I think that was appropriate. Ultimately, we are whipped. All of us are whipped. We all have to take responsibility. We were all given the same brief around the financial situation that we were in. It was an SNP amendment. It wasn't a Labour amendment. It was an SNP amendment. SNP are targeting Labour councillors and Labour MPs in Scotland and have spent the last 2 months campaigning against them. So it undermines our colleagues there. So I do think it's right that we maintain discipline as a party, because we have some incredibly difficult decisions to make as well going forward. And it sends a message that we are going to have to make some difficult calls and we all have to work together. Ultimately, we all benefit if the Labour government succeeds. The country benefits if the economy starts growing again. And so I think he made the right call on that.
More recently, we've seen these riots across the country with damage to businesses, vehicles, attacks particularly on sort of areas like mosques, and violence towards the police and ethnic minorities. Now, you were a special constable once upon a time. What's your reaction to all this?
Well, look, three things. First of all, there is absolutely no excuse for some of the behaviours that we've seen. Absolutely none. There's no justification for trying to set hotels on fire, for attacking police officers, chucking urine, faeces, for intimidating local people, for chasing people, for smashing and damaging property. There can be no justification for that in any democracy. We do not allow political protest to become violent. So that's my fundamental. I think the government has responded robustly on this issue. And as we can see in the news, people are being put before the courts and the courts will make decisions on sentencing and outcomes. Secondly, there is a conversation around social media and its responsibility. I am worried about some of the comments on Facebook from people, some of them inadvertent, some of them are directed, but also the multi-billionaires who own some of these internet companies, social media companies, do have to accept responsibility for some of the proliferation of information that is coming through on those and the whipping up of concern and fear. And then thirdly, there is a concern that I have around, you know, the issue. It's, you know, what the issue was. I mean, the issue came as a result of three stabbings in Southport. That was not related to someone who was a migrant. Despite all of the misinformation, that has still, we've lost sight of actually some of the real reason why some of this has started. And actually, I'm worried about the fact that people can feed off of complete fake news and then it can cause such destruction. And I think we do have to reflect on that in terms of how our society responds to information and fake news.
I mean, you've referenced there, I mean, a lot of people, Elon Musk, among others, has been sort of accused of allowing Twitter, or X as it's now known, to proliferate extremist views and things that have contributed fake news and this sort of thing. I mean, is that something that the government will look at, possibly legislating around sort of how social media companies allow this to happen?
Yeah, so Peter Kyle, who's our Minister for Digital, has indicated that he's going to be doing some work on this going forward. Obviously, right now, the focus is on ensuring that we have community cohesion, that we get these riots quelled and we can move forward. And I think there needs to be a wider conversation, probably at a later time, around the responsibility of digital companies. I think we need to engage with them in a sensible way. Obviously, governments have to ensure that we maintain that freedom of speech, which is so important in a democracy. That right to protest is also important. But what we can't be allowing is fake news to spread and proliferate, because it causes fear in communities and it can lead to violence and social decay as well. So there needs to be that conversation. What it looks like is for that conversation, but I suspect it's coming down the track.
Now, we're only about a month into the new parliament. So looking longer term, what are the things that you'd like to achieve, both as a national Labour government, but also locally, specifically for Chatham and Aylesford?
Yeah, so, and the two are linked, actually. So first of all, I think a period of economic stability. Now, that sounds like you've heard that from every politician, and it sounds like the last 20 years of political discourse. But the reality is that we have had countless prime ministers, countless chancellors. We have had instability in relation to inflation caused by people putting budgets forward which weren't sensible, and they lost their jobs because of that. So we need a period of stability with Rachel Reeves at a stable hand at the tiller. We need to balance the budgets and we need to grow the economy. And actually, the second element of that is the plan. It's ensuring that people in Chatham and Aylesford and more broadly have more money in their pockets in 5 years' time, that they're able to afford those holidays, to go out with their loved ones, that they're not in a cost of living crisis that we've seen, that mortgages are affordable. And I think actually, if we can deliver that stable economy, that growth, that will result in dividends for us. Secondly, the NHS. You know, we do need to look at how the NHS is working, the fact that people can't get a GP or a dentist. Now, Wes Streeting has come up with a plan on that in terms of recruiting extra dentists, working with universities to increase placements. Thirdly, it's around crime and antisocial behaviour, obviously a big issue at the moment and one that goes back to me as a councillor, you know, looking at how noisy nuisance bikes and people who are not insured on cars and noisy neighbours, looking at policy around that, around more community sentencing, but actually for people to see that they're, as victims, they're getting an outcome. And then just lastly, it's around supporting education, which for me is very important. 3,500 extra teachers, specifically maths and science teachers, which we're going to fund through private attacks on private schools. Now, that is controversial, but having worked in a state school, I know that there's a massive recruitment problem. And actually ensuring that state schools get those resources, which they haven't had for 14 years, where 92% of the students go, is a real priority. I know that that will cause controversy and I look forward to the debate on that, but I think that is the right decision.
My final question, I mean, I mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you were a school teacher and obviously you had to deal with a fair amount of bad behaviour, I'm assuming, as a teacher. Is the behaviour any better in the Palace of Westminster?
Do you know, I have been asked that question a few times and I can say that the behaviours are, certainly some of my Year 8 classes came very close to some of the behaviours that I've witnessed. Certainly more controllable in the classroom and they're slightly less rowdy as well when you look at PMQs as an example. But ultimately, you know, both require calm management of the situation, restraint and an ability to see through the screams and the howls. And they're quite similar in that sense.
Tristan Osborne, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Just coming back to the riots, why did Kent escape the most serious unrest, Anne, do you think?
Just in purely logistical terms, two of the places that were listed on this, what some people were calling a hit list of places for far-right protests, were pretty out of the way. The one in Canterbury was way up on the hill near the university, which is pretty barren at this time of year anyway because it's summer holidays. And the one in Chatham was at this innovation centre, which is quite far out of the town centre near Rochester Airport. But also, it's just, you know, there's not, you know, there are, in absolute terms, there are very, very few people who care enough about politics for any reason to take part in a protest of any sort.
Especially when it's not near a railway station as well.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Think of it. When you go to protest, you hear a lot of people, especially in Kent, you hear a lot of people with accents who clearly aren't from here and have travelled down from elsewhere in the country. And that's fine if you're making a weekend out of it and you're coming on a train, but if it's on a Wednesday night and you've got to get, you know, 5 miles away from the nearest train station or something, you're not likely to come.
Well, how much of it do you think it to do with the day before there'd been news of somebody getting jail for 3 years for his part in the Southport unrest. Why do you think that may have played a part in terms of deterring people from going out and having a barney with the police?
I think that is absolutely the case. I mean, the Keir Starmer, as we've sort of mentioned, has kept this strong line of, you know, we're going to crack down on this criminality. We're not going to accept this sort of behaviour. And I think, you know, I think there are sort of three groups within these riots as they've been elsewhere. They're people who are really bought into this idea of sort of the far-right element of it. There's people who are sort of a bit more, not quite as strongly believing in that, but think that immigration is a problem and they need to demonstrate that in some way. And then there's sort of idiots who are just going along looking for an excuse to smash up a shop and rob a Greggs or whatever. And I think once the actual consequences of those actions come along and they see it's not just a bit of fun and it is actually quite serious and they could go to prison, a lot of people will think twice about this sort of thing. And as that news came out, as you say, as people began to get these sentences and they saw that the full force of the law would be coming after them, I think a lot of people stayed home.
Well, Starmer, it's comfortable territory for him because he's a former director of public prosecution. So he knows how the system works. And he said, we will get them before the courts and we will jail them within a week of the offences being committed. So he's been true to his word. So from a political point of view, Dan, do you think that in the short term he's sort of diffused this problem, but perhaps has a problem in the longer term?
Yes, I mean, like Paul said, some people might say this is the end of his honeymoon period. I think quite the opposite. I think this plays quite well for Keir Starmer because he can look loyally and disciplinarian, and that's, you know, exactly what he wants to do. That's kind of his a part of his public image that he's capitalised on. But on the other hand, like I say, in the short term, dealing with immediate criminality, you know, banging up people who've committed obvious crimes on video and all this kind of thing is all the government has to do. It'd be crazy if any government didn't do it in response to this kind of thing. But in the long term, it's obvious things like this don't happen in a vacuum. Most people are not interested in extreme right politics, but it is obviously the result of long-term trends in public attitudes towards migration and the way that politics and the media address and deal with it. And I think the government will be quite comfortable for now to say that the solution is more surveillance, more influence for the police in public life, more, you know, harsh policing of this kind of thing. But the causes of this, while a lot of it is criminality, is ultimately political, and therefore the solution to it has to be political as well. And I think also it will damage the politics of people who are not extremists of any sort arguing for migration control as well for sort of the next immediate few weeks. I can already foresee people within the government who suggest, you know, maybe this means there needs to be a conversation about how we talk about immigration and immigration policy. People accuse them of, you know, oh, you're just giving in to the rioters. So I think whatever they do in the short term, however many rioters they bang up, it won't change the sort of long-term structural trends which have contributed to this kind of thing happening.
Paul, how do you feel Starmer has come out of this?
I think he's done reasonably well. One thing that struck me about this series of events is that only the other week we were talking about not enough prison space and prisoners being discharged and court trials being delayed. And here we are. This week, talking about about justice being dispensed in a matter of days. And there is that contrast there. Yeah. I think, as I said, you know, earlier, Keir Starmer, I think, can't afford to be seen as soft on criminality because that will immediately hand the Conservatives the opportunity to say that he's weak on law and order, and he doesn't want that to happen.
I was just wondering sort of how you feel the opposition parties have responded to this. I mean, from what I've seen, the Conservatives haven't been that loud on this, and Reform are in a sort of a strange position where some people are actually accusing Nigel Farage of sort of instigating some of these events. I mean, what's your view on that?
Well, I think there's an element of truth in that, but I think, you know, when it comes to mainstream politics and, you know, ordinary voters, there are still those outstanding concerns about the cost of living crisis, the recession, and what the government is going to do about that. And I think what's been interesting about the Conservative response to all of this is that it's been fairly muted, but no one's really taken any interest in it. And I think that's going to be their problem for the next few years, is that they'll be developing all sorts of policy ideas, but frankly, no one's going to be that interested.
So it'd be interesting that whoever makes it through to the final two and whoever finally gets elected as the new leader may well just be one of a long succession before they find somebody that the public will listen to.
Yeah, I don't see any return for the quiet man, as Ian Duncan Smith, who threatened to turn up the volume after getting criticised for his lack of initiative and was out of the job within about 2 weeks after saying that.
That's right, because he made a speech at the party conference that, you know.
Yeah, he might have been better off dancing like Theresa May did to him.
Folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Rob, Dan and Paul and our special guest, Tris Osborne. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.